He's a world-renowned zombie scholar, professor of zombies and popular media, and co-author of the book Zombie Mania, one of the first exhaustive guides to zombie cinema. He's Dr. Arnold T. Blumberg, the Doctor of the Dead.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
Well, hey, everybody, and welcome to episode 97 of Doctor of the Dead. That means we're only a few episodes away from episode 100, and we recently did a little Twitter poll, and I just was curious to see if people would respond when I asked what you'd like to hear for episode 100, and Natalie had already suggested doing the huge task of running down a top 100 zombie movies, and that was far and away the winner of the poll, so that's probably what we're going to wind up doing.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting, actually, to do essentially a top 100 worth watching.
Yeah, what you should see.
What you should see, because not everything that I would recommend people watch is necessarily quality.
No. Yeah, that's right. Because there's stuff that's fun, but that's crap.
So. Yeah, or stuff that did something interesting or kind of groundbreaking, but is otherwise not much of a contribution to anything.
So that's 100, and it's not far away. But in the meantime, this is episode 97, and we've got a few things to talk about this time around, including continuing our sort of survey of zombie films that we've been revisiting during the month of October. Mostly stuff from the 2000s, but we have been varying that a little bit. And of course, last time we took a look at Nightmare City. This time we've got another pair, one of which I had not yet seen, and one that's an old favorite for both of us. And I say old favorite, but it goes as far back as 2004. Shaun of the Dead, and then we also watched Juan of the Dead, neither one of which are Dawn of the Dead. And of course, we also have to talk about Z Nation, the latest episode of Z Nation, which is what we're going to lead off with.
What is this place?
You don't know?
We're slaves in the zombie funhouse of death.
Sorry, kid.
So the latest episode of Z Nation, there's some confusing stuff going on. I always look up on the Wikipedia page or their pages to find the titles. Last week's episode was called A New Mission, Keep Moving. Now all of a sudden I've seen it listed in a few places where it's just called Keep Moving. And I'm not sure why that is. This one has been turning up in a lot of places, including on the site as The Unknowns. However, on some, and on the Wikipedia page, it's now being listed as Fear of the Unknown. So I don't know what's going on right now with titles on Z Nation.
This must be their spinoff, Fear the Z Nation.
Oh my god.
And
yes.
This just launched it. You just didn't realize it.
That's right. Fear the Z Nation coming soon, which will be just slightly more boring than the regular Z Nation, and then you'll lose interest. But it'll still be on if you need it.
But you'll get to see him on a boat briefly.
And then eventually Citizen Z will cross over into Fear the Z Nation, if he ever shows up again in this one. So this week, Unknowns, Unknown, whatever. This episode was one of the quintessential examples of what you would call a bottle show in that, well, not technically a quintessential example, really. Let me backtrack a bit, because really, when you do a bottle show, you usually do it with only the standing sets you have and only the cast you have. This really doesn't do either. They obviously did a lot of work, but I would say a bottle show in the sense that it felt very contained and, for the most part, very limited in the physicality and what happens. But I guess about halfway through, I realized what it really should be called is a box show. So this is Z Nation's box episode. Basically, we have our team trapped in some vaguely Saw-esque, cube-esque set of traps. Also felt very akin to Portal 2. For those of you that know Portal 2, you know exactly what I mean. Particularly a scene late in the episode where they come out of the exit into this big wide open field. And I was like, oh, these people have played Portal 2 many a time. This episode, I have to admit, I found frustrating on several levels. And you go ahead.
Well, it was sort of this combination of Saw, but also like Groundhog Day. Mm-hmm. Where it's like you wake up and you're like, well, I'm in the box again. And like, I get what they were trying to do, I think. Maybe I don't know. But I'm not sure it fully achieved everything that they were trying to do. Because what I liked about it is that it was something completely different. Like, last week we got ostensibly another bottle episode where it was sort of the Z Nation guys doing what they do. They're trapped in a field full of cars. They got to fight off different zombies all while bickering amongst themselves about something. And this time, there was basically no infighting. I mean, it was just all that got stripped away because there was something far more important and sort of gruesome happening around them. And it kind of showed them how much they care about each other by being separated repeatedly. That, you know, Roberta's in the box, but she can hear Murphy, but now Murphy's gone. Or, you know, Doc wakes up alone the first time, and then he's with 10K a second time. And it sort of reacquaints everyone with everyone and their problem-solving abilities. But beyond that, I'm not really sure I understood what the point was.
Well, I mean, half the episode is incredibly tight close-ups of them in boxes. And if you're trying to save money and trying to work on a very limited set of resources, which, let's face it, this show has excelled at doing in many other ways, this was a perfect example of how you try to do that. Basically, the episode wound up feeling very much more like what you'd expect out of sort of an experimental stage play. You know, where you'd have people standing on a black stage with spotlights on their faces. And it's like, let's just imagine everybody's in a box. And of course, it plays on a very primal fear, the premature burial kind of thing of being trapped in the box. There were some inventive camera touches in that so much of the episode was driven by close-up. I did think it was kind of inventive and neat, that sort of POV thing of the switch on the gas mask between 10K and Doc. That sequence was, you know, a clever visual technique. But yeah, but apart from the experimentation of it, I just felt like the entire episode was an exercise in tedium, which was shocking to me for enjoying the show so much, because if this was indeed the setup for a mystery that is going to unfold, like, who is running this ridiculously overcomplicated operation where apparently they capture people, store them in boxes in a huge Raiders of the Lost Ark warehouse, occasionally select a few to release to do something specific in another room, like in a video game, and then return them somehow inexplicably to their boxes while also controlling them using a screeching noise that I was done with the second time it turned up, and you were far more agitated by it.
The noise, I can completely understand using it the first time so that the viewer kind of gets a feeling of this is what they're experiencing. But after that, it was actually physically causing me pain. And I feel like, for the benefit of the audience, I would have very much liked if, after the first time, the camera just went into that sort of wobble mode and everything got blurry, and it was understood that the noise was playing again, that's what was affecting the characters, or do something that's like lower level, sounds more like a hum to us, but we understand what it's doing to them. Because it did get to a point by the end of the episode where I wasn't watching 100% because I was just kind of flinching, waiting for them to make that noise again and having to cover my ears and you having to find the mute button.
Yeah.
And I will say, on the other hand, for people for whom that is not physically painful, I'm sure that there are people who would enjoy that kind of experiential viewing of, like, feeling like you're right inside the story with them. Every time they get knocked down, you're getting knocked down with them, kind of thing.
True. But as people, and both of us, I think, are like this, who neither enjoy the idea of in-person haunted hayride kind of stuff where very amateur actors deliberately try to jump out and scare you, which neither one of us finds remotely entertaining, or the escape room kind of thing where you evidently enjoy claustrophobia as entertainment. Again, not something I would like. Then that kind of thing doesn't work for me.
Yeah, no. The only enjoyable time I ever had in a haunted house, this is a completely unrelated anecdote for
everyone. Oh, that's fine.
But I lived in China for a number of years.
We're done. We're almost done with this episode anyway.
And when I was living there, there was this huge park near my house that had essentially a little amusement park inside of it. And one of the things they had in there were all these museums and also rides and things like Haunted House, where you'd buy the tickets and you could go in and it was year round. So my friends and I one day were like, well, let's just see what this haunted house is like, because why not? Mm-hmm. So we go in and we could hear, as soon as we walked in, on the walkie-talkie, the person running the show in Chinese was telling everyone else in there, well, there are foreigners walking through, because I guess they have their script that they use in Chinese, but they assumed that we wouldn't understand, even though we would.
I see.
And so the whole time, it was basically just a maze with a black light.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave you, like, the glasses you wear, so it makes everything look a little darker.
Mm-hmm.
And then every so often, a hand would shoot out behind a sheet, and the person would say, hello! Because I guess that was kind of the extent of the training they had gotten in, like, how to handle someone who didn't speak your native tongue. And by the end of it, we just piled out of there laughing hysterically. So I think it had the opposite effect.
The most polite monsters ever.
They just wanted to welcome us to their haunted experience.
I guess so.
But that is literally the only time I've ever enjoyed that kind of thing. And, I mean, some would say it's ironic, I guess, that the two of us love horror so much, but we love it from the couch.
Yeah, I've often had questions like this. And like, people say, well, what's your favorite scary movie? Like, what movie really scares you? And it's like, I've never watched horror to be scared. And it's also not, just to clarify too, it's like, it's not that I consider those things scary. Like, I'm not avoiding the haunted attractions or the mazes or the escape rooms because, oh, you don't like it because you don't like being scared. No, I don't like it and none of them scare me. And I'm not saying that to be a challenge. I'm saying it's just, I just don't have that reaction to that. It's like having an idiot in a costume jump out at you and like make you jump. That's not being scared. That's just an autonomic response.
Yeah. I mean, I'm good not paying to sit on like itchy hay that gives me hives while a stranger feels it's okay to touch me.
Yeah.
And I'm good.
You're good with that.
I'm good.
And so it's never been a thing for me. And similarly with film, with television, with all the things I've done with zombies or everything else, I don't seek them out because I enjoy being scared or that I even find them scary. I like the stories. I like the characters. I like what they say about us. I know that sounds really pretentious, but then if you're already listening to this podcast, you know, what are you going to do? And I like the experience of the story like anything else. Like, I don't watch The Wolfman because werewolves scare me. I watch it because I'm fascinated by the character Larry Talbot, and I like his story.
And I think maybe that kind of touches on the central point that was the sticking point for both of us with this episode of Z Nation, is that this thing is happening. And yes, it just keeps happening, and there are all these challenges and weird rooms and poison gas and an elevator key and all of that. But for both of us, I think there needed to be a resolution or some kind of reason that summed up the story of it. And because there wasn't, we both kind of felt like, well, then why did we just watch them do that?
This goes back to something I'd started to say earlier and didn't finish, which is that the problem I found this whole episode was, if this was indeed a setup for a thread that will be explored throughout more of the season, who was running this ridiculously complicated operation? What was the point of that entire thing? Because within this entire episode, nowhere do we ever get any explanation of what the point of any of it was. The operation itself, the capturing the people, what the end goal was. It's all meaningless unless there's more to be learned. And if there's more to be learned, fine. Except that even in that, I felt this episode did not, and to be honest, I don't really have an easy answer for this, like what would I have expected? But I did not feel like this episode signposted well enough by the end that this was intended to be anything other than a single episode event that we're just going to leave behind. If we're going to find out later this is something Zona does, or if this is another group, or perhaps, here's one, what if this is actually connected to Numerica in some way? But never did we get even a glimmer of, oh, I see, this might be something. They just went through it, it ended, and then we left. And if this is supposed to be something we build on, then we would need more. And I felt that ultimately this was, I just think this was one of the weakest episodes I think the show has ever done. And I think it was saved entirely by the fact that another thing Z Nation does well is it has always done well under great restriction, financially, production-wise. And like we've already said, came up with interesting ways to present what is otherwise a very limited story. Like that same stairwell that kept being in a variety of different ways. And the strength of an ensemble that is so seasoned at this point that you can get moments like I think we both just started really breaking up at Nat Zhang in particular, really doing well this year with a few things. And his scene with Doc where they're reminiscing about dog food. That's Z Nation. Right there in those couple minutes, that is why we love the show. Those two guys are awesome together.
Well, I think also we've sort of realized in this current season, it's that dynamic between Doc and 10K that kind of captures the spirit of what we've always liked about the show.
Mm-hmm.
Like they have this moment as well in the episode where Doc says something along the lines of, we're, you know, trapped in a funhouse of death, and talks about it right. happening again of like, you know, how do we always get ourselves into these ridiculous capers? And right. like only Doc could see this as a ridiculous caper. I think that Doc and 10K should start a post-apocalyptic cooking show because they really understood the finer points of dog food.
How to get the gravy going.
How to get the gravy going, yeah. Which brands are going to really stand out to you.
And the person not to include on the cooking show is Murphy, who is continuing to, if not being scared, I will say, completely grossed out, and which is such an odd reaction to have when you know that all we're seeing is Keith Allen peeling a piece of like deli meat or something stuck on a prosthetic and eating it. And yet the act of that feels so overly transgressive and dark that he's eating himself. It is so creepy.
That close up of him peeling his own skin off, I think, is the closest I've seen this show get to horror. It's like
that's
that
a very
was
good point.
That was a horror shot.
Yeah.
That they did right there. Because it was slow and you would like see it pulling away before he pulled it off. It wasn't mm-hmm. like he, you know, looked around and grabbed a quick snatch of skin. I mean, it was a close up on the spot. And that was, it was also gross. It made me feel gross things, and I'm not sure how I feel about it. I also don't know that we're necessarily going to see that again because Murphy was bitten at the end of this episode.
He's probably going to now go to whatever another stage is of whatever this is. I mean, obviously, like I was saying since the beginning of the season, something else has got to happen with him now.
Yeah.
His normal window, if there's any consistency to this character, would have to be very limited.
Because, I mean, the fact that when he got injured and he was eating his own skin and finding that to be, I guess, both enjoyable and nutritive in some way, says that he is not completely so-called cured from whatever it was he had before. So then the question becomes, what does a bite do to him?
Right.
Because the bite is obviously making him ill,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he's convulsing in the back seat.
Will he merely transform back into something resembling his blue state from before, or do they have an idea of just doing something completely different with him again?
Yeah.
Because he's been through so many different permutations.
I would be very intrigued to see which direction they go with that and whether or not it has any impact on his relationship with Lucy, or maybe Lucy is going to need to bite him in order to like make that
to save him
happen.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the thing is, it just shows, even in an episode that I certainly think was a weaker entry, if you're following these characters and you're interested in this unfolding saga, there were still interesting things, from great character moments that were funny to significant moments that signpost the development of the Murphy character. And it's like, okay, I'm along for the ride. I'm just curious about whether anything else that happened in this episode will have any relevance at any point. And we still have many questions hanging. So, for instance, where did everybody in the camp go? We still don't know about any of that. Where's Addie? Citizen Z, of course, we know didn't get back to Kaya yet anyway. So we haven't seen her. We've only heard her. There are a lot of people missing in action here in different ways that hopefully will turn up.
Like an entire camp full of people.
Yeah.
Just went poof.
Yeah.
And then it's been a couple episodes, and we haven't really addressed the fact that people are disappearing into thin air.
And Sun Mei had become sort of part of their team, but they don't seem particularly interested in locating her at any point.
Unless I am only just now coming around to this revelation here.
Okay.
Which is slightly changing my opinion of everything that was part of this episode. What if all the people who disappeared, the soldiers on the road, the people from the camp disappeared because whoever this is made that sound happen? They were all incapacitated.
Oh, they were also grabbed. Taken. See, that would have paid. That would have been a nice payoff for this episode if they met Sun Mei in one of these little missions and we found
out. Or even
just
one of the refugees from the camp.
Yeah.
Like,
it could still happen.
It still could. Because it strikes me that when they finish the episode and they're back by the truck where they started, they find their stuff in the middle of the road.
Yeah.
And other people's stuff too. Like, other people have just been disappearing in place. And that's exactly what it was like when they came upon the convoy.
That's right.
Where all the stuff was there. Although I don't understand how, if they came upon the truck that can be remote driven and emanate that sound, why they just let them walk past the truck after they escaped from the funhouse of death. But it occurs to me that maybe that's where this is going.
If it is, then I think I would appreciate this one a little more for having fit into a larger puzzle. But we'll have to see if that's the case.
Because obviously there were a lot of boxes in that warehouse.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of people that have passed through there. And there are also people that they're continuing to pass through there because they could tell more people had been taken in the couple days since they were taken.
I will say that remote control truck is pretty advanced technology for post-apocalypse. But then, of course, Zona's out there too, so whatever.
Yeah, and she'd seen a couple of Zona soldiers, you know, sort of down in the basement of this place and felt like maybe they were responsible for some of this. They realistically would be the only people who would have had the resources to set all this up. So maybe that's where it's going.
We'll see.
Once we've seen a few more episodes, if this does end up all tying back together, then I think it'll change the experience of having watched this one.
I think so. Just as a side note, we were mentioning some other influences that appear in this episode. Everything from Raiders of the Lost Ark with the box shot to a few other things. But I should mention the truck scene for anybody that remembers Duel. There was quite an echo of that with the truck driving on its own. And some people mentioned the cell. Another connection, but I also wanted to give a little shout out for the torso zombie who very much reminded me of the one that jumps them in the parking garage in Dawn of the Dead, the 2004 Dawn of the Dead. I have another one like that.
It also kind of harkens to the zombie that's in pieces in the elevator in the cabin in the woods.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, we'll see where this goes. To our feature films, and we are doing a pair this time again, as we've been doing for most of the ones we've done this month. And we decided to pick two that had some thematic similarities as well as some similar titles. And the first one is one that I hadn't seen yet, which itself was quite clearly inspired by the other film that we're watching. This first one I'm talking about is the 2011 movie One of the Dead, which was very clearly inspired, at least partly, by 2004's Shaun of the Dead, which we'll talk about second. But I hadn't seen One of the Dead yet, and you had.
Yeah, it was my chance to introduce you to a zombie movie for once. It all actually kind of ties back into how we met in the first place.
This is true.
I had decided that I wanted to watch more international zombie movies that, you know, pretty much I'd only seen either U.S. or U.K. films, and I had reached out to you on Twitter and asked for some suggestions. which you came back immediately with Burial Ground, which I did watch and mm-hmm. I enjoyed. And then you enjoyed the fact that I enjoyed it, and the rest is history.
Yep.
But I decided, even though there are plenty of movies that I could watch from a single country, like there are plenty of Italian films I could watch, there's plenty of Spanish films I could watch.
Right.
I decided, at least for that little experiment that I was doing, I was gonna just watch one per country mm-hmm. for a while. And I think I managed to get through about a dozen or so, and I still haven't done a write-up of it, but I'd like to eventually. But when I'd seen that there was a Cuban zombie movie, I was like, well, obviously that has to be on my list. And it is, it's a joint venture. It's Cuban-Spanish, but the entire plot takes place in Havana. It is a remarkably funny film.
It's a very funny movie. It has a great cast in it. It has the benefit that I've often felt comes only when you watch a film from another country from which you don't know anything about the careers or the other work of a given group of people. I sometimes feel that particularly with movies like, say, a zombie movie, you have the benefit, from our perspective, of watching what amounts to people that just look like people, if you see what I mean. I'm not translating into, oh, I know, he also starred in these 12 other movies, which you would get if you're watching something that's homegrown. So there's an element of realism to it, even as goofy as this is, that helps. It has a great sense of humor. And at least, although we'll spend most of the rest of the time talking about that separately, in comparison to Shaun of the Dead, it has a much darker, harder-edged, cynical sense of humor. And a lot of that, I feel, comes from the political angle of the film. It is also a perfect example of a modern zombie movie that has taken to heart the general concept that a zombie film comments on the sociocultural situation in some profound way. And I also felt while watching it that I was at a bit of a disadvantage in a way I've only ever felt when watching Japanese or Asian zombie movies, where I'm not as well versed in some of the cultural angles as I would be perhaps in some European or American films, certainly, because there was a lot of commentary in this movie that clearly was very pointed. Certainly there's the running gag that they're referring to the zombies as dissidents and what iconoclasts and all that. And you get the general idea, but I also feel that I'm not appreciating it nearly as much as a Cuban audience would appreciate it for what it's saying.
And I think part of the reason I appreciated it so much when I first watched it kind of touches back on what I was mentioning earlier, in that I lived in China for 6 years. And so I've had the experience of living in a country that has a fairly firm grasp on all of its citizens. Mm. And so when they first threw out the line of the government being on TV and talking about how, you know, there were some dissidents creating trouble in the city, it reflected a lot of things that I had seen broadcast on the news in Beijing, mm-hmm. where it's like, I would know the story is a whole bunch of people were pissed off because the government, you know, bulldozed their entire village and they were trying to get compensation. But they would say that there was, you know, a bunch of angry dissidents that had tried to create trouble, and don't worry about it, we took care of it.
I do also like that at one point in the movie where things are really full blown, it's like full zombie apocalypse, that they're getting news from the government about how, well, everything's over now, everything's fine. And meanwhile, they're looking out the window and it's the end of the world. There's no denying it. That the absolute insanity of being willfully, you know, willfully ignoring it, not really ignoring it, but just telling your citizenry there's nothing to worry about while their guts are being ripped open is an amazing commentary.
And the fact that they keep referencing, especially towards the beginning, the fact that these dissidents were being paid for by the American government.
Right.
And it kind of feels very topical somehow right now in reverse.
Sadly, yeah. Sadly, very topical. It's a movie all Americans, zombie fans should watch, I think. Our lead characters are very much in the mold of Shaun and Ed as two friends, you know, and in the classic comedy styling of the thin guy and the fat guy. This is like one of these traditional comedy concepts. Their relationship is heartwarming when it needs to be. But like I said, there's a harder edge to the whole thing. Unlike Shaun of the Dead, these are not good people.
They're anti-heroes, for sure.
Yeah, they're anti-heroes. I was actually taken aback at one point when one of the main characters consciously murders another living person in the midst of taking out zombies because it's somebody he wanted to get rid of.
He did owe him money.
Yes. Yes, he did. But in that moment, I was like, wow, we're really doing that. And there's like a level of morality to this film that's a little bit jarring until you get into it, because it's a very different. And I also felt that went along with it a little culturally. Like, I wasn't quite clicking into the idea that, like, these can still be perceived as heroes from a certain perspective, or like you say, anti-heroes. But to me, I was thinking, wow, these are murderers and criminals. But they're also our POV characters. There's also one who's concerned about his daughter. And there's the one who's really devoted to him like a brother, you know, even though they're just friends, but they have that relationship. And there is warm-hearted stuff, but it's dark.
I think the best way to describe it is to say, what if the Sean character, in this case is Juan, is actually more like Ed, and then Ed's sidekick is an even more Ed-like Ed? It's like, it's not quite nailing it, but that's sort of the idea.
That's pretty good.
That Juan is like highly functioning, and he's sort of scrappy, and he's perfectly happy with his life the way it is.
Like many of these characters in apocalyptic stories too, whether you believe it or not, they seem very quickly able to handle an extraordinary amount of physical activity. But we do get the fact that he has done that before.
Yeah, that he fought in Angola.
Mm-hmm.
He talks repeatedly about how, well, I survived the special period, I can survive this, which is a great way to put it into perspective, I guess, in apocalypse. Like, if you don't know the history of the region, essentially, when the Soviet Union dissolved in 89, Cuba really got hit hard because they were part of that whole sort of Soviet grouping. And there's a lot of resources that are not native to the island that they benefited from being part of that group, because they could get, in particular, resources like fuel cheaply from the Soviet Union, which they're not producing. There is no, you know, oil reserves in Cuba. And also because it's an island, they were relying pretty heavily on trade from other places. So this wasn't like a gradual economic downturn. This is not like the economy went bad. It's that there was a day where the Soviet Union dissolved and all of the supply lines got completely cut off. And Cuba was left floating alone out in the ocean for quite some time. So it was the kind of stories that you hear where you think, well, that couldn't possibly be true, but plenty of people say, no, that was true, of people eating their cats. And, you know,
so an apocalypse, perfect, a real world apocalyptic situation.
Apocalyptic situation, mm-hmm. where they were essentially eating their pets, that people were surviving on much less than they had previously been accustomed to, because they just had to ration everything. It was a situation that they did manage to sort of eventually pull themselves out of,
mm-hmm.
but ultimately sort of they're still doing it. Like, they're still in the process of it, and they survived it.
Well, even
it's sort of like, it's something that's, they've proven already that an apocalyptic scenario is survivable.
So in even more of a sense than we could do, this story is a perfect commentary on that, and says this is what we're capable of. Like, the Juan's character, like, his refrain is something about, like, he'll survive. He can survive.
This that
is
what he's a survivor. That's just what he's done his whole life.
And they do, and like I said about it being inspired at least partly by Sean, there are even some plot beats that I feel they borrowed and then made their own. Like, in both films, there's sort of a climactic moment where our heroes are surrounded by an insurmountable horde, only to have someone in a car or a truck show up and change the game a little bit. And in this, it goes quite a bit more comically than it did in Sean, where that's sort of really the conclusion of the action in the film for all intents and purposes. I'd also point out the effects in this are kind of dodgy. They're not great. this is like, I remember when we first started watching it, one of the things you said to me was the nice thing about this is a real film. Like, this isn't just something somebody shot on like a digital camera, like a lot of stuff we've seen. It's a film. It's nicely made. It's well acted. It's nicely scripted. The whole thing is structured.
There is cinematography involved.
Yes. And yet, I would say the effects are not great. They're perhaps sci-fi level a little bit. I think that's about it. There are occasional shots of like things happening to buildings where it's like, okay, I know that somebody is sitting at a laptop putting that on CGI, but it's pretty good. It looks nice. The zombies themselves look good. A lot of the gags with them are great. That truck scene I was just talking about that basically involves like spinning a ripcord around and taking everybody's head off is a great concept. They come up with some clever stuff of their own. In keeping with the dark side of things, there's a scene that I really liked where in order to kill a zombie, they use a harpoon, but they wind up effectively murdering a living person while they're also trying to take out the zombie. There's stuff that is both funny and dark, and also, I would say also like Shaun of the Dead, does not play the zombies for laughs in any way that undermines the central concept. It uses them in a way that then allows them to reflect on their culture and their characters. And it's a little goofier and a little more overtly cartoonish than Shaun of the Dead. I also thought that it took the zombie concept seriously. And as a result, I think it's a very successful blend.
Yeah, and I think what I in particular liked about this, and I guess we hadn't really touched on this yet, but one of the central plots of this is that Juan and his whole crew are trying to figure out a way to make some money off of what's going on around them, especially in the beginning when it's clear that like there's some going on, but it's not clear how widespread it is or how devastating it's going to be. So they decide that they're going to start a business where they will kill people for you if they've turned. And they sort of cheerfully answer their phone by saying, Juan of the Dead, we kill your loved ones. And it's funny every time they say it. And ultimately, I'm not sure how word of mouth spreads for them to get more business, because every single time they go in to dispatch people, there's the chance that they're also going to dispatch the person who just hired them to kill off the zombies. But it's those situations, too, that give them a chance to add more commentary in as well. There's this woman who's running a boarding house, and she is telling them how many people there are staying upstairs. And she talks about the difference between how many rooms she's actually letting and how many rooms she tells the government that she's letting.
Oh, right.
Because there's restrictions on what you can do. And she's sort of saying, you know how it is. Times are tough. And it's just sort of this wonderful little beat in there that didn't need to be in there. They could have just shown up and she could have said, well, there's, you know, four rooms for rent upstairs and they're all full of people. But they kind of worked that in there in just such a natural way that I think there's an element to a lot of modern zombie films that drives me crazy, which is a lot of them try too hard to make the commentary.
Oh, I've talked about that many times. I think that very often commentary needs to happen more organically than to sit down and say we're going to deliberately do this.
And this is a very clearly political film, but it works. It should be a political film for what it's trying to touch on. And it does it in a way that really feels natural for the viewer. Like, they didn't have to stretch to try to figure out what's the message we're trying to drive home here, because the message was already there. The message was there, and they built a zombie movie around it.
I absolutely agree. And I think, obviously, we both highly recommend it if it's a zombie movie that listeners have not yet seen, which is possible. Certainly, a lot of fans are keen, as you were when you were doing your experiment of trying to look for all the many different permutations that are out there around the world. Juan of the Dead's a great example. I'd also say that similar to Marvel films, make sure you stick through all the way the end credits or you won't be 100% clear on how the movie ends, which is a really nice touch that I liked a lot. But let's move on to the other film in this pair, and the one that clearly, at least in part, inspired Juan of the Dead, and also a film that I'm revisiting it, I couldn't be more certain in my original estimation from years ago that I think this is, I don't know, this time around I felt even more certain than ever, this is one of the best examples of the genre ever, a modern classic, perhaps one of the top three zombie movies of all time, which is Shaun of the Dead from 2004, a movie that came along right post 9/11 at a time where the modern 21st century zombie resurgence was getting going, and Shaun was part of that resurgence, along with 28 Days Later in 2002, the launch of the Walking Dead comic in 2003, the beginning of the Resident Evil franchise, the Dawn of the Dead remake that same year, and Shaun of the Dead, a movie that is clearly reverential to and inspired by Romero's films and everything that the Dead movies did. Simon Pegg, Edgar Wright as director, writer Nick Frost, and their entire group, beginning what later became known as the Cornetto Trilogy, where they did three films that explored various themes and concepts and characters that, while not sequels, very much fit together. And the other two being Hot Fuzz, which I also think is one of the most perfectly structured movies ever, and also a wonderful Halloween film, even without zombies. And the final one, which I think was deeply flawed, World's End. But Shaun of the Dead is extraordinary. It's a movie that pays homage to the genre, and yet I think manages to capture the best of it. And I don't think I've ever been as effusive about it as I am now. I think in watching it again, I just was struck by how wonderful it is. I also think it's a script that should be taught in every script writing class. Every line of dialogue, every setup has a payoff later in the film. It is one of the most beautifully designed movies I've ever seen in terms of writing. Like, just as one, almost every casual line has a double meaning and references something zombie-like that happens or something later. There's like the great scene early on when, you know, Sean has broken up with Liz and Ed says, this is what we're going to do tomorrow, you know, and he lists all these things they're going to do, which sound like he's talking about, you know, having a drink, have a bite at the King's Head, do this whole thing. And then when you watch the rest of the movie, you realize he just described everything that happens for the rest of the movie, only he didn't know that's what it was going to be. It's beautiful.
You know what we should do tomorrow? Keep drinking. We'll have a Bloody Mary first thing. Have a bite of the King's Head, couple of the Little Princess. We'll stagger back here. Bang! Back at the bar for Sean's. How's that for a slice of fried gold?
And I love that right from the start, you know that they are fans of the genre.
Yes.
This is not a situation where they're trying to make fun of it. I mean, they love it.
When the movie begins and you first see the production company logos, the first sound you hear is the warbling music cue from the original Dawn of the Dead when they land to refuel the helicopter. This is clearly coming from a place of love.
And they have those little touches that get sprinkled throughout, that when he calls to try to make reservations for dinner, the restaurant's name is Fulci's. It's right. Fulci's Restaurant. When he's on the phone with his mom, Ed is screaming into the phone, "We're coming to get you, Barbara.
We're coming to get you, Barbara."
Ash is off work and it's 4E Electronics. I mean, it's like it's endlessly rewarding through the whole movie, all those little bits. Yeah.
So I love that they love the things that I love.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that is what drew me in. I mean, the first time I saw it,
mm-hmm.
and on a rewatch, especially because we've been revisiting a lot of these movies, it just made me appreciate even more how lovingly they treated the topic.
Yeah. It could have stopped there. It could have been, let's do the best homage to all these things we love. And yet it doesn't. What it delivers on, and this is sort of what I was talking about a little bit with Juan, and I've said this many times and like when I've taught my zombie class and lectures about it, what I love about Shaun of the Dead is how it never parodies or makes fun of the zombies or the apocalypse itself. This is a real thing happening in the real world. The characters are also not excessively cartoonish. They're funny and there's a lot of humor. But the humor derives organically from their relationships and the way they interact with one another. There is never really an unrealistic or false note. They're just people. But the humor derives from the dialogue and witty repartee and occasional touches as if like you would in your life when you have a laugh with someone who's a friend. And I love that, that there's certainly room for parody. That I'm not saying that's bad, but what I love about it is this is a serious movie, and therefore it also earns its moments of genuine pathos and tragedy, including what I think is one of the most emotionally moving deaths in a zombie movie I've ever seen. Everybody knows this anyway, but when Sean's mother dies, that still makes me tear up sometimes. And it's just so beautiful, and she plays it so well. They all do. And yet you'd think, well, wait a minute, this is a comedy. It's not just a comedy. It takes it seriously, and it earns those moments, and it's great. And I don't know. I'm just particularly taken with it this time. It's been a long time since I've seen it, and it's a truly great example of what this genre can do.
It's been quite a while for me as well. And I think one of the things that you benefit from in rewatching it is really keying in to all of those elements that are going to repeat themselves. That, you know, obviously the first time you see it, you kind of have this vague feeling of, oh, wait, they talked about that earlier. Oh, wait, this is the same line, but they're using it differently. And it's like watching it again, you already know that they do that. And so every conversation that they're having, every interaction that they get into, like I found myself really closely watching that first scene where Sean's leaving the house to go to the shop to pick up a soda. And, you know, I was really paying closer attention this time to what exactly is going on in the street. Who are all the people that are there? What are his interactions with them? Where were they in this shot or that shot?
Mm-hmm.
And then watching again when he leaves the house the next morning to see everything around him that he's not seeing, which in and of itself, it's like if that was the only commentary that the movie made, it would still be fantastic of how much goes on around us that we're not paying attention to or we're completely oblivious to,
right?
Even when it's right in front of us, because mm-hmm. we're just bogged down by all this other stuff, by our exhaustion, by the daily grind, by our own personal tragedies, whatever it is, that we all, in order to, survive, really. I mean, we tend to put up blinders and we don't really see what's what.
And this also goes back to something we talked about in Zombieland, which is you get a lot of that setup of commentary right in the title sequence in this movie, with the whole opening sequence setting up many characters that you then see, you know, in very different circumstances later. But the monotony of modern life, like you're saying about, you know, what we don't see and how Sean wanders through his morning without any real concern about what's around him. And we see that while they're waiting for public transportation or the kids in the hoodies who are later the ones that attack when they're trying to get Philip and, you know, his mother in the car, and Mary, the one who works at the shop, who's going to be the one in the backyard. And you see that monotony playing out at the beginning. And of course, even Sean himself, who bookends the movie with his, you know, zombie lurch out into the living room in the morning, is a perfect commentary. And of course, Pete reading them the riot act about the fact that, like, how can we keep on living like this? And, you know, we're just wandering through life and they're basically like zombies. There's great stuff in this. I think the movie is so good that sometimes I think we don't even notice just how meaningful a lot of it also is, because it's too easy to get wrapped up in how just genuinely joyous and entertaining the structure of this whole thing is that I don't focus as much on what's being said. I had forgotten, this is something I wrote back when we wrote Zombie Mania. At the time, Shaun of the Dead was one of the most recent films we had to cover, because we actually wrapped up the book with a cutoff date of 2005. It was really impressive at the time. But of course, everybody was cataloging all the stuff in the movie from, you know, the Ash references and the references to Romero films and Fulci and all that. And then something had occurred to me, and I was talking it over with my co-author Andy Hirschberger, and we wrote it. And I haven't looked really to see. Maybe other people have come across this, and I don't recall ever coming across this in an interview about it. But one thing struck me that I felt nobody else was picking up on. Sean is 29. They talk about how he's turned 29, and he's talking to the kid who's 17. He's like, I got stuff I still want to do with my life. And at the end of the movie at one point, they specifically mention how many shotgun shells they have left. And it's 29. And then he starts shooting them, and they all go awry. Except for one, I think. He gets one headshot. And by the end of the movie, there are only two left. And they leave the gun with Ed. And he winds up using the last two. And it occurred to me while we were writing the book, was the shotgun shell thing a commentary on the fact that Sean had wasted most of his life, had occasionally done something right, but basically wasted 29 years. And then when it counted, and he wanted to set up a future, which was a future with Liz, Ed, the one that everybody was telling him the whole movie was holding him back, winds up really being the one that he needed to, you know, let go. And it's Ed who fires off the last two in order for them to be happy. And I just thought that might be a little too profound in reading into it, but I love the idea that, like, the 29 shotgun shells are his life.
I don't think it's too profound in reading into it, in particular with this movie, because every single element of this movie was so carefully written, so carefully staged out, that I can't imagine there is anything that happened by chance.
Okay. Well, that's reassuring then. I also want to mention, by the way, there's a nice little tie into our previous episode. This is also, I revisit Zombie Mania every time we do this, if it's a movie we covered, so I can see if there's anything I'd want to share. And at the time, somebody had asked Simon Pegg, how could the apocalypse have spread that quickly? And he said in an interview, well, maybe somebody got bitten on a plane, died, reanimated, bit everybody on board, and then the plane of zombies landed, and they came out of the plane and caused more carnage. And at the time I said, whether he knew it or not, he was basically describing the opening of Nightmare City. So that was interesting. But since we're talking about pathology and some of these other things, there was one interesting wrinkle to these. They're basically Romero-esque zombies. There's a brief bit where we hear a thing about a space-borne radiation, a space probe. So they're deliberately referencing Night of the Living Dead.
And I love, by the way, that when he finally settles into the news broadcast, one of the broadcasters refers to them as shambolic.
Yes, shambolic. And they also, at the end of the movie, mentioned the 28 Days Later rage thing as being bull, and then it cuts off. But there's that. Their behavior is pretty much your standard Romero shambler, except there are a couple interesting things. Like, one is, well, this is also like Romero, but like there are occasional moments where it seems like there's echoes of their previous life, whether they remember or not. Would one of them serves as a nice little joke where Philip, you know, while completely turned, still turns off the music in the car, or, you know, the shopkeeper who's coming after Sean with his hand out, like he's still waiting for the money that he owes him.
Pete responds to his name.
So they, yeah, there is actual evidence. And of course, Ed's behavior at the end would suggest that they are capable of some extra cognition. And of course, we do see that zombies are starting to be used in various walks of life and on reality shows, which makes perfect sense in this world, maybe more now than then. Jeff Probst would probably be involved in that, I think, at some point.
If nothing else, Mark Burnett.
Yeah. Your award challenge. Want to know what you're playing for? Delicious meat. So there's that. If anybody didn't know that I've been watching Survivor now they know. So there's that, but there's also the weird thing that serves mainly as a cute moment, cute sequence, but the fact that they can go through the crowd and just moan and behave, and they react to them, but clearly not enough until they start speaking, shows how the reaction of these zombies depends on your behavior. It's not just that they can smell you're alive. It's that you need to behave like a living thing for them to really get activated to come after you, which, like many of these things we've talked about over the episodes, is one interesting little specific permutation about how these creatures react to you. You can hide amidst them, and you don't have to camouflage yourself like Walking Dead. You just need to behave like them, which makes it easier for them. But it's, you know, it's a cute moment, but it's also interesting. Since you got to take that part seriously and figure, well, it's okay. So smell doesn't matter to these zombies at all.
Just behavior, which is honestly kind of fitting in with a lot of the themes that run through it. That this isn't just some sort of animal urge that they're having. They're not driven in that way. It's human beings who have been transformed into a different type of human being. They're not merely hungry, but they are hungry. but that's not the only thing. And, you know, part of that too is seeing that they do hang on to some of those vestiges of being fully human.
I can't think of much else to add right now. I mean, if we were doing an entire episode on this, I probably would delve even deeper into some things. But I just think overall, the takeaway for me is that I was truly, truly impressed by how well it holds up. And like I said, top three, I'm not someone that usually likes to quantify or like put a list, but I really think this may be one of the most perfect zombie movies ever devised. It is brilliantly written. It's very joyful to watch in terms of everyone performing to the best of their ability and getting every laugh out of the humor and yet still feeling very real in the moment. And it has a lot, like we said, it has a lot to say that maybe you miss because you're enjoying it so much. But it's just an excellent, excellent film. Can't think of anything else to say except that I'm very impressed by it again.
And that if you've seen it, see it again.
Because yeah.
It's definitely worth rewatching, especially if it's been a while.
Yeah, and certainly, like we just said, with all the callbacks and the echoing that goes on, it rewards multiple viewings, so you can really pay attention like you were. You mm-hmm. can really pay attention to where all that's coming.
And that'll do it for this episode of Doctor of the Dead. Find a complete archive of this show, along with many other podcasts, at itunes.com/G2V. Be sure to subscribe for the latest episodes, and if you like what you hear, rate and review. On Twitter, follow Arnold at Doctor of the Dead and Natalie at NB Latovsky. Doctor of the Dead is a G2V and ATV Publishing production.